You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to the Ready Room, Episode 10, Chakotay's Stockholm Syndrome. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including comics featuring the Abramsverse and a Legion of Superheroes crossover, a Star Trek VI sequel novel, StarTrek.com's Jeffrey Combs interview, Will Wheaton and Jerry Ryan on Eureka, Netflix, and the new TNG review podcast, Dork Trek. In our feature, we'll be joined by Down in Front's Brian Finifter and Trek FM's Anthony Davis to discuss the Voyager two-parter, Year of Hell. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How is everything up there in Tiny Tower this week?
Oh, it's great. I just opened a bakery and a bike shop, and I've got a brewery that is being constructed. I am spending way too much time on my iPad. How's everything down for you in Tokyo?
It's going pretty well. You know, yesterday after lunch, I started listening to our show from last week, and I just finished. And so, so this week, I had Dr. McCoy give me an injection of chronooxolene. It's a medication that helps you speed up as you work your way through news and so forth. So we're hoping that this week's show will be a little bit shorter for our listeners.
Hopefully. I liked last week's show, but I don't know how anyone could possibly listen to 2 hours of us talking about Star Trek.
Well, to anyone who did, we appreciate it very much, and also really encourage you to pick up the enhanced podcast in iTunes, which has chapter markers for all the news stories and the topics during the feature, so you can kind of listen a little bit now and a little bit later. But let's see if this chronooxolene works here as we jump into the news for this week. And so, Greg, what do we have up first?
Yeah, well, possibly this chronooxolene will be used in the comic reboot of the original Star Trek show, which we've talked about a few episodes ago. IDW is this fall sort of redoing original series episodes in comic form. And they're starting with the pilot episode, the second pilot of the original series, Where No Man Has Gone Before, which is, of course, the story of Gary Mitchell. And we learned this week that it's not just going to be one issue per show, because issue 2 is also going to continue the story of Gary Mitchell and Where No Man Has Gone Before.
Okay, that's good to hear. I think you kind of have to do that with the comics, unless you want them to be like our show and be really long,
right.
In order to get the whole story in. So interesting that they're starting with Gary Mitchell. I mean, I guess it's what I would expect because, like you said, that was the original second pilot. Of course, it wasn't the first episode aired, but it was the first episode shot after the cage was rejected by the studio. Do you think that this means that we definitely will not see Gary Mitchell in the movie?
I think that's got to be for sure at this point, yeah. Which I don't think I'm going to miss him. I love that we're seeing it again. I love that he's still going to be a part of the Abramsverse. But as a movie, I like that they've decided to simply move past the original series in the movies and not try to just do a retread. But I'm really fascinated to see what they do in the comic for it.
Well, I see the illustration, the cover illustration, and they've got Gary Mitchell with glowing eyes, and it looks really nice. I'm curious to see what they do with the story, like you said. If it's going to be a straight replay, which I imagine it won't be, because I don't think fans are going to be too interested, especially in comic form, of just seeing a straight replay of the story.
Right.
Except Kirk looks like Chris Pine, and Spock looks like Zachary Quinto, so... definitely I'm going to pick this up when it comes out. And, I'm also curious to see after this, if they continue with TOS episodes or if they're going to kind of intersperse some original stories along the way, which we've heard they're going to do, but when are they going to get to them, I guess is the question.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. Yeah. This reminds me of back in 2009, I sort of was thinking about the Star Trek sequel, and I thought it'd be cool if they redid Space Seed, with the younger Kirk and Spock and the whole crew in this universe. And I sort of thought of how these characters would interact with Khan if they came across him. So with that in mind, I'm now looking forward to, I'm sure eventually they're going to get doing Space Seed on the comic. And it'd be cool if they do some of the same things I thought of.
Well, I wonder if they'll do what I thought of, because this actually came up on Twitter yesterday, and the topic of Khan in the new timeline. And someone said that just because Khan might appear in the new timeline, it doesn't mean that events have to unfold the same way
right,
that they
exactly.
did in the original. So what I was thinking is that they find Khan, they wake him up, and it turns out that Khan is this doctor whose specialty is removing worms and parasites from people's ears. And then the Enterprise is damaged, so Khan helps them repair the Enterprise so they can get on their way. And then they return him to his home on Seti Alpha 5, which is this beautiful, flourishing planet. I don't know if I'll go that route or not, but
sounds pretty good. I like it.
I mean, if you want to depart, if you want to avoid any accusations of rehash, that's the way to go. So.
That sounds perfect. I don't know. I like the idea that Khan and Kirk like become best friends, and that Khan sort of takes over the Spock role on the series. And Spock sort of becomes a Khan officer, and Khan becomes the science officer.
That would work, too. It's kind of like bosom buddies in space.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Of course, that would imply that Kirk and Khan would be dressing in drag, so...
Well, maybe. Maybe we don't want to go in that direction.
Maybe not. Well, speaking of departures from the Star Trek norm, and while we're talking about comics, there's another interesting crossover coming from IDW.
Yeah, in the same press release, IDW talked about an upcoming crossover, which is between the Legion of Superheroes and the Star Trek crew. Now, to those of you who might not be as familiar with comics as others, the Legion of Superheroes is sort of like the Justice League. They're a DC group of superheroes. They were originally there for Superboy years and years ago.
They're a group of aliens, teens, right?
I believe at least they used to be. There have been several reboots.
Okay.
And I think they're on to like the fourth team, and I'm not sure exactly who's in the team at this point. I lost track after the, you know, third or fourth time. But they live in the 31st century, apparently, and they have found some way for both of them to come together in the 23rd century in an alternate timeline. And I believe it's six of the Enterprise crew and six of these Legionnaires, and they're just going to interact and solve this mystery, and I have no idea what this is.
Well, now, is Nero responsible for bringing them together?
That would make sense.
We'll have a Star Trek Legion of Superheroes and J.J. Abrams verse three-way crossover going.
Oh, that'd be fantastic. We have the Legion versus William Shatner versus Chris Pine.
Okay. Well, like you said, they've gone through a number of revisions of or different generations of Legion of Superheroes. I'm not that familiar with this comic, but this is what I understand from what I do know about it. And I think in this one, they're taking the original team, I think the teens.
Oh, okay.
And
that makes sense.
Then the original Star Trek cast as well, because this is Kirk. This is Shatner, Kirk,
it
Nimoy,
is,
Spock.
Right.
This is the original TOS crew that we're talking about here. And then the original Legion of Superheroes.
Okay.
Two of them teaming up. And what I also gathered from it, it says that they're entering a short story. They're entering a story shortly after the Great Darkness Saga, and the Enterprise crew is picking up shortly after the original series.
Right.
And in Star Trek, and as I understand, in the Legion of Superheroes, they both take place in these kind of optimistic futures.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that they're going to try to do here in bringing them together in this alternate timeline is to put these two groups together, team them up in an alternate future that's not so optimistic, to see how
right.
they handle that situation, how they interact with each other. Like you said, I don't really know what to make of this.
Mm.
It's one of those odd crossovers that you get from time to time in comics. So we'll have to check it out.
Even the writer says that when the guy from IDW, Chris Ryle, approached him, he thought it was a prank.
he thought they were
just leading him on.
Right. Well, that's because just before that, he said, what we want to do is we want to take the Star Trek crew and we want to combine them with the Jeffersons. And And then he said, and then after that, we're going to bring in the Legion of Superheroes. And therefore, he thought it was a prank, but they were actually serious.
Well, there was that crossover between Frasier and Voyager that I think went very well for...
Well, that was very funny. That was very funny.
I don't know if too many... We'll have to link to that in the show notes. Star Trek.
Yeah, crossover. That was, what, a sketch from an award show in the late 90s, right? With Martin's chair on the bridge next to Janeway. That was wonderful. Definitely, we need to dig up that link. I think it's on YouTube, right?
We'll talk about this on the Frasier podcast we do every week.
That's right. With our co-host, Eddie.
Right.
Well, moving on from comics to novels. Mm-hmm. There's also a novel coming out for our fans of the original series that picks up the events of Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country.
Right.
And it's kind of a post-Kittimer Accords story, which talks about something that was really glossed over in The Undiscovered Country, which is... In the beginning, we see Praxis exploding, and that sets the whole storyline into motion, and it brings together the Federation and the Klingon Empire to the Kittimer Conference, which leads to the Kittimer Accords.
Right.
But we really never get into what are the repercussions of the destruction of Praxis. It's really just kind of a tool to set the plot into motion, and then it's all forgotten.
Yeah.
Pretty much after the movie.
Yeah, this is one of the lost periods of Star Trek that we've talked about, how sort of after the end of Star Trek VI and the beginning of Generations, there's this huge period of time that we never really hear anything about. And especially, I mean, the Klingon Empire was really brought to its knees at this point. But all we see at the beginning of Next Gen is, oh, well, there's a Klingon on the bridge, and so there's some sort of... at least some level of peace going on, but we never delve too deeply into it. But I guess this novel is trying to talk a little bit about that. Have you read this DS9 relaunch novel series? Because it says that the story features Elias Vaughn from that series.
Right. I've read the first couple of books. I haven't read too far into it. You know, the problem with that series is that... It is a continuation of the TV show in a sense, and like DS9 was, as a TV show, you have to follow it or you get lost. And so as the new ones have come out, I see them and I want to read them, but I know, oh, I have to go back and I have to read this and this and this and this to catch up. So at some point, I'm definitely going to do it because, of course, with it being my favorite series, I want to get into it. But yeah, Elias Vaughn was a crew member on the Enterprise E in this continuation series that you're talking about. In the novel Avatar, which is by S.D. Perry. And the Enterprise E discovers the Orb of Memory.
I always forget that one.
You always forget that one. It was lost in the Badlands in the 24th century is how the backstory goes. And the Enterprise E discovered it. And he led a team over to recover the orb. And he had an encounter with the orb. If you open the orb and you have this encounter... And it impacted his life, and it led him to accept a position as the first officer of Deep Space Nine.
Okay.
So that is how that kind of just ties into the Star Trek storyline, and I guess why they're kind of pulling this character that we're not really familiar with from the series into this book.
Okay, so it's him and Valeris. It says the book is equal parts Vaughn and Valeris, who everyone remembers surely from Star Trek VI, sort of a character they created because they couldn't get Robin Curtis back to play Savick.
And then, which I'm glad that happened, actually, because Kim Cattrall, much better in that role, I think, than Robin Curtis would have been.
Yeah, definitely. And then, so the cover of the book doesn't have Vaughn at all. It does have a big Leonard Nimoy face. But this review that I read from Trek Movie says that Spock has, at best, a 10-page cameo. So not much Spock. If you're looking for a lot of Spock, he's not in it much. But there is a lot of Valeris, and you sort of get into her backstory and find out why she did what she did in Star Trek VI.
Ah, interesting. Yeah, Trek Movie said they didn't really like it, right?
Right.
But I guess the cover art with Spock being so prominent is to sell books.
Oh, yes.
If you just had Valeris as the prominent figure on the cover, you would sell fewer copies. And if you had Vaughn, people would say, who the hell is this guy?
Right, exactly.
So you've got Spock on there to get people's attention. But, you know, I don't know. It could be that the story itself is maybe not that good.
Right.
I have no idea without reading it. That might be why they say they didn't like it. I would be kind of interested in filling in some of those gaps and finding out some of the backstory about Valeris, though. Because when you do jump into a story, I mean, the movie has to move along. So there are kind of things that you want to know that just kind of are left unsaid. So sometimes these types of books are interesting.
Yeah. What I'd really love to see, actually, is a book series about the Enterprise C and Captain Garrett. Do you know if there's been anything like that?
Oh, good question. Off the top of my head, no. I imagine that it has been touched on, at least to some extent, in some novels. That would be something for us to go back and kind of check into.
Yeah, I'd love to see, especially if they could put the new Enterprise C from the Ships of the Line calendar, put that on the cover.
Yeah, that would be nice.
Give us some great new stories about that sort of lost Star Trek period.
Yeah, so I guess what you're saying is you'd like to see a series, like we have Star Trek Titan, or we have this type of series about a specific ship. Like, let's do a series of books, maybe 10, 12 books or something about the sea. Yeah,
exactly.
That would be a nice little addition to Star Trek universe.
So speaking of nice additions to the Star Trek universe, StarTrek.com did an interview with Jeffrey Combs, who is one of my favorite of the guest stars. He was on he was on DS9, he was on Voyager, he was even on Enterprise. Let's see if we can name all of his characters. He was Brunt, Wayoon, he was Shran. Let's see, who else?
I do feel like he played someone else in Star Trek, didn't he?
He was two or three other characters. He's in the wrestling episode of Voyager.
Because he said he was so glad to meet The Rock, right?
Yes. The Rock walked up to him and said, please, please call me Dwayne. I don't want to
be
The Rock.
Okay, I'll call you Dwayne, he said.
Yeah, I'll call you whatever you want. I'll call you, you know, Mr. Johnson, whatever. Yes, sir.
I can't remember the others. Obviously, he's best known as Wayoon and Shran. Right. Probably best known as Wayoon because I think DS9 had a bigger audience than Enterprise did. But although he really had a great role on Enterprise as Shran.
I love Shran. We'll talk about that in a second. But so he started out on DS9. He said he auditioned for Encounter at Farpoint, but didn't get the role. I thought maybe he could have played that creepy fabric salesman. He would have definitely a good face for that.
I think that's something for the remastered. You know, like in Star Wars, the way they put Anakin in, you know, in the remastered. Let's just swap out the creepy fabric salesman with Jeffrey Combs and be perfect.
That would be perfect. But so they didn't like him for that. But then there's an episode of DS9 directed by Jonathan Frakes. And I don't have the episode in front of me, but he came on, I believe, for just one episode. Was it to play Wayoon? Or I believe it was to play a different character.
Well, I think he played Brunt first. Yeah, he played Brunt, the Ferengi, first.
Right.
Who would come in. What was Brunt's role? He was kind of like a representative of the Ferengi bank or treasury or something, who would come in and harass Quark all the time. He hated Quark.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And so they loved him a whole bunch. And he said, while they were actually on production in that episode, Ira Stephen Baer came up to him and said, you know, we've got to get you in a role that uses less makeup, that lets you show off more of your face. And he sort of said, that'd be great. Not really expecting it to happen. But then DS9 was making this character of Wayoon, and they called up Jeff Combs right away.
Yes, and he is an amazing actor. Showing his face, I think, was really important because obviously seeing someone's face is important for any actor, but Jeffrey Combs in particular does so much with his expressions that add depth to his character. Yeah. And it really shows in Wayoon. You see it again in Shran. You see it again in the 4400, where he has a major role.
Yeah, I was noticing. I thought you would have seen him
for
that
as well. Yeah, great character.
What I find really interesting is that he was Wayoon and Shran, and in both of those cases, they showed his face. Although, you know, as Wayoon, he's very pasty white, and then as Wayoon, he's that paisley blue. But his face, he holds his face differently. With Wei Yun, he has these big open eyes, and he talks about how he's your best friend. He's sort of like Littlefinger from Game of Thrones, if anybody watches that. But then on Enterprise, he's got this scrunched up face and these squinty eyes, and he's always, you know, growling. And I was showing my girlfriend the pictures, and she didn't realize that these five guys were actually all him, just because he shows that emotion, you know, through the makeup or even without makeup. He shows the character in just his face.
Yeah, he does. And he approaches the roles very differently, gives each role its own unique character. And it works. I mean, that's true. You know, when Shran came on, I guess you kind of immediately, at least for me, immediately noticed that, oh, it's Wei Yun, it's Jeffrey Combs.
Right.
But you're never distracted by it. You never feel like, oh gosh, they're just using the same character over again.
Right. Exactly. And I like that he says that he, as, when he was playing Shran, he thought of the Americans and the, or the, sorry, the Vulcans as the British, and then the Andorians as the Irish. And so he gave the role this Jimmy Cagney feel. He just, you know, sort of tough little guy, he says, who holds his ground. You've got to go through him, not around him.
And I thought that was like that.
It's really great. Now, I actually saw him as Shran before seeing Wei Yun. So I sort of came to it from the other way. When Wei Yun showed up, I was like, that guy looks familiar, but where are his antenna?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That would be interesting if Wei Yun had antenna.
Yes.
Okay, so you approached it that way. So for me, it was the opposite. I went from Brunt to Wei Yun. And with Brunt and Wei Yun, you, of course, visually, you don't pick up on it. It's just the voice a little bit.
Right.
But even then, he does a really good job of separating those.
Right.
Well, let me ask you another thing that came up in this interview is, he says that if Enterprise had continued to season 5, Manny Koto had said that Shran was going to become a regular cast member, as I understood it, on the bridge of the Enterprise, as if he was going to join the crew.
Right, exactly.
What do you think about that?
Well, on some level, I think that every time Manny Koto has a good idea for Enterprise Season 5, he rushes out and tells someone just to make Paramount feel bad about canceling the show. You know, we would have done the Romulan War. We would have had William Shatner. Shran would have been a recurring character.
So these are retroactive ideas that he has and just kind of leaks them out.
It's possible.
Did this originally come from Trekkie Leaks?
Trekkie Leaks. That's good stuff. But as an idea, I do think it's a wonderful idea. I would have loved to have another alien on the bridge and... certainly somebody tougher, sort of maybe Worf or Yar, have somebody more like that on the Enterprise bridge.
How do you think the personality of Shran and Archer would have worked together if they were actually on the bridge together all the time? And obviously Shran would have had to be a subordinate to Archer if he
would have had to be
a member of the crew.
But sort of by the end of the series, he had come to this understanding with Archer. They were becoming really good friends, and I think he could have accepted his role as a subordinate. You know, it would have been something like, I don't know, maybe the beginning of Next Gen, where Picard and Riker were sort of at odds because the way Riker thought of being a first officer was so different from the way Picard wanted him to be as a first officer. But, you know, as time goes on, they could have developed that relationship even further and really showed Shran looking up to Archer and really taking his advice. And at the same time, Archer could maybe learn to be a little bit more aggressive at times, you know, take quick, decisive action rather than thinking so much about what to do.
Yeah, I think some of that comes from the fact that the series got cut off after 4 seasons, because if, as we've said before on here, we think that Scott Bakula played Archer the way he should have been played in the beginning, because everything was new, and he's kind of obviously tentative that way. As the series had gone on, he probably would have gained more confidence, been more decisive on things and all. So one more thing before we move off this topic. A very disappointing thing about Enterprise being canceled when it was, is that we didn't get to see the Federation being formed on a proper timeline. And we kind of jump ahead in the end of the fourth season of Enterprise, we kind of jump ahead and we see the ceremony where the Federation is being brought together. So one thing I wonder here, if you're bringing an Andorian on as a crew member, bridge crew member on here, does that imply that in season five, do you think we were going to see this formation of the Federation where the Andorians are becoming part of Starfleet right, as opposed to being another race?
Yeah, I bet that is actually probably one of the things they were thinking about doing. I know, I'm not sure how the timeline exactly works out, but I know at some point soon the Federation is supposed to be formed, and as the hostilities with the Romulans start happening, they need to start making some allies. Mm-hmm. And I bet Shran would have been a huge part of negotiations with the Federation. That would have been great to see, you know, Shran on Earth talking to Admiral Forrest and explaining why the Andorians could be such good friends of the Federation.
Yeah, it would have. So disappointing for me that really Enterprise was canceled. There was a lot of potential, especially in the fourth season. So much was going on. Well, speaking of Star Trek actors, another story here on a Trek alums on a non-Star Trek show. We have Will Wheaton and Jeri Ryan, along with Felicia Day on Eureka.
Yeah. Now, Eureka is not a show I've been watching faithfully, I suppose. It is a great show. It's on the Sci-Fi channel, or I guess it's called Sci-Fi now. And it's actually a lot like Star Trek in some ways. It's about this small town where there's a lot of technical advancement going on. The plot is really confusing, though. So I'm coming in midway through the fourth season, and I'm basically lost. But the one thing that's keeping me grounded is there's Will Wheaton, who's just joined the cast. He did one episode last season, and sort of like Wei Yun, they loved Will Wheaton so much that they brought him back as a regular for the second half of season four. And I don't know if you've seen Will Wheaton in any stuff recently, but he's really grown as an actor since Next Gen. He's grown a beard, but he's also grown a lot as an actor.
Yeah, I was going to say, everyone's loving Will Wheaton these days. I unfortunately have not had a chance to see him in anything yet because I haven't gotten access to the things that he's on. Big Bang Theory, we're not quite there yet to where he starts turning up.
Okay.
And Eureka is a show that I kind of dabbled in when it very, very first started, and I haven't really returned to it since. I've been thinking about it. Now that it's into a fourth season, I kind of have a policy, especially with sci-fi shows, of not watching them until they've been on for a few seasons, because I just got so sick of everything being canceled on me.
Right.
I'm tired of watching the first season of a show. Sometimes you don't even get, it's not only sci-fi, I mean other networks too, you don't even get through the first season of a show before it's gone.
Yep.
And I just feel like it's time wasted. So I might go in and check this out.
What
did Will have to say about his time on Eureka here?
Yeah, it's interesting. It was an interview with IO9, which is a really good sci-fi website, and they asked him about the technobabble on Eureka, because he's playing a scientist who works for the, I forget the name of it, Global Dynamics, I believe, the science company on the show, and he does a lot of technobabble, and it's a lot like his character on Next Gen. So one interesting thing he says about the technobabble on Eureka is that it comes from science advisors. And even, he says, with the made-up science our science advisor comes up with, a way to take that fake science and give it at least a toehold in reality, and things follow a logical flow, unlike Star Trek, where they just made up words that sounded technical. You know, we've talked about Ronald Moore says they just would write in the script, you know, Captain, we've got to tech the tech so that we can tech the tech and then tech the tech, tech, tech. Tech-a-tech.
Exactly. It's like I was watching Year of Hell yesterday. We're going to talk about in our feature today. And at one point, I think Tuvok says, Captain, if we tech the tech, we can tech the tech, and it may be enough to tech the tech.
Exactly.
And I'm like, okay, thanks, Tuvok. Now I know exactly what's going on.
They forgot to do a find replace on that part of the script.
That's right. It slipped in.
Let's give Star Trek its due. They do have science advisors on Star Trek as well, and they do come up with some fake science. But I think because Eureka is supposed to be present day, and because it's a show not as much for sci-fi fans and Star Trek fans, it's a show for geeks. And geeks love to hear, you know, deep technical explanations of stuff that's boring to most people. So,
when I read Will's comment here, I know what he means to some extent. At the same time, you know, Star Trek has had science advisors on all of the modern series,
definitely.
I think. And I do think that they make, it's a very difficult job for them to balance real science with 24th century science, to find things that make plots work, to try to make things feel real, yet both futuristic. And sometimes they do a great job. Sometimes they come up with stuff that you just shake your head and you go, that just doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah.
You know, overall, I mean, it's important that they've had science advisors, and Star Trek obviously has done a great, has been a great inspiration to people over the decades to get into science. And so, yeah, it's a little bit of both here. I know what he means.
But this last episode, if you haven't seen any Eureka, honestly, just jump in with the episode Up in the Air. It's got a great hook where there's a bank robbery, but it's not anything taken out of the bank. The actual bank has disappeared. And then things start floating in the sky, and they have to figure out how to drop them to the ground. It's really good. You've got Felicia Day and Will Wheaton spouting an awful lot of technobabble. And you've got this sort of, if you ever saw Dr. Horrible, you have this, Felicia Day is caught between Fargo and Will Wheaton's character, Parrish. It's a really great character-driven sci-fi. If you like Star Trek, you're going to like Eureka 2. And later in the season, Jerry Ryan's going to show up. So there's even another reason to tune in.
All right. Yeah, I think I'll go grab that episode that you just mentioned there and check that out. And then if I like it, I will hop right in.
Yeah, and a great place to just catch single episodes of shows is Netflix, Netflix Instant Streaming, which we talked about a few weeks ago, is starting to show Star Trek. All the series, I believe. Oh, no, DS9 won't be on until September.
I think it's October 1st.
One of those. For some reason, DS9 was extended, but we were complaining that it was only for the U.S., even though Netflix streaming is in Canada.
Yeah, that's a problem for Netflix. You know, those of us, those in the U.S. maybe don't realize how much the studios try to block people outside the U.S. from gaining access to content. To the point, you know, you can't watch video on websites. You just get pop-ups that tell you that it's not available in your region. Things like Netflix are not available.
I still haven't seen the latest Weird Al video because it's not available in Japan for some bizarre reason.
You know, we just put a news item on Trek FM last night from our new enterprise writer, Shanna Gilkison, about Anthony Montgomery's music career. And he's released a new single called Stimulation. And in posting this article, I wanted to put the music video in the article so that everyone could see it. And I went to VH1 and I checked. And yeah, sure, they have the video there and they have the embed code. I click play and the video immediately jumps to the end like it's over. I hit play again, immediately jumps to the end like it's over. Finally, by clicking through, I got to another VH1 area where it informed me that this video is not available in your region. So exactly the case here is going on. And as the way this ties into Netflix, of course, is with Star Trek, those outside the U.S. have been very uncertain if they are going to be able to see Star Trek streaming, even in North America. But fortunately, we do have some news on that.
Yeah, finally, they've announced something. We know that Latin America is going to be getting the original series and Next Gen. And I don't know, the press release is really fuzzy. It says that CBS has a deal with Canada and Latin America, but it doesn't say exactly what shows. But I'm assuming that unless we hear differently, by September, by the time this launches, Canada and Latin America will be getting all the Star Trek shows and be able to get on board just like the United States.
All right. Well, I hope so. Maybe this is one small step for those of us outside the United States to see distribution terms and licenses that are brought up to the 21st century and the digital age, which is something that's very slow moving.
Definitely. I'm really looking forward to signing up for Netflix. I'm actually moving back to the U.S. next month now. And so I'll be getting this. This will be one of the first things I do. And just I'll let you know how the streaming on Netflix goes.
All right. Well, you tell me about that, and I will tell you how quickly the extraordinary slow motion Netflix style streaming of DMM goes here in Japan, which we finally are getting some kind of service like this going. But right now, basically, we can see the first season of Lost, and I think that's about it at the moment.
It really,
unless you like anime, there's lots of anime.
Right.
Well, if you do have Netflix, you can easily pop in The Next Generation. And if you want to have a great time watching The Next Generation, we want to encourage you to tune in to a new podcast that we just got hooked up with this week called Dork Trek. And Dork Trek is, you know, on this show, we get a little bit geeky and serious when we talk about episodes. And Dork Trek is kind of the opposite of Vice. Dork Trek takes a great, really fun look at The Next Generation episodes. And they say all those things that you might be thinking.
Right, exactly. I remember back when I was watching Encounter at Farpoint with you for a few episodes back, we were Skyping back and forth during the show and just laughing at some of the ridiculous stuff. But then, you know, when I get on the show, I want to be more serious and talk about the more important things from the episode. Dork Trek isn't quite as interested in the important things. They're more interested in just having fun with Star Trek. It's sort of the way I like to watch, especially the original series or Next Gen, where I just want to have fun with it and just point out some of the amusing things. Not that I'm hating on it, but
exactly.
It's fun. It's a fun show. Sometimes Star Trek is just fun.
Yeah, it's a good point. You have to understand that just because you make fun of something happening in Star Trek, it doesn't mean you're hating on Star Trek. You know, the original series, you can watch the entire series with nothing but a comedic eye and have
yes.
the best time. I mean, in some senses, it's better than the greatest sitcoms.
Yep.
And Next Generation, especially in the early seasons, there's a lot of that going on. Mm-hmm. You know, the Dork Trek crew, they it's mostly a humorous look at Star Trek, but they do make a lot of great points about the plot, character development, and things as well, mixed in with their humor. Mm-hmm. So just, I really encourage everybody, hop over to dorktrek.com and check out this new podcast, and you'll have a great time.
Yeah, I wanted to say one more thing, that I love supplementals. You know, as I was watching DS9, as I was watching Voyager, I was always reading the Memory Alpha page for each episode, and Will Wheaton's book, Memories of the Future, I was reading that along with watching Next Gen. So I love these things that go through episode by episode, and you can sort of hear what other people think about the show as you're watching it, and just adds a whole other layer. And I'm so glad that Dork Trek is with us. I think they're four shows in, and so they're like seven or eight shows in.
Because they do a couple of episodes in each podcast.
Right.
Yeah.
So I listened to the first today. It was great. I can't wait to listen to the rest.
Oh, they're great. I've been through most everything that's available. So absolutely fun stuff. We were teased with it during season 3 of Voyager, in Before and After, and then in season 4, we reached the Year of Hell. Last week, we talked about the concept of time in Generations, and here in Voyager, we once again have this concept of time. And joining us today is friend of the show, Brian Finifter from Down in Front Podcast.
Hi, guys.
And also, we have Trek FM political science editor, Anthony Davis. Hello, Anthony.
Hello, what's up?
Welcome to the show. All right, guys, so the Year of Hell was a really big Voyager story that did not involve the Borg. And
probably
I think it was
from one of those timelines.
Right. Yeah, they may have been. I always enjoyed this story, both in concept and kind of in the scope of the story. It felt like one of the bigger Voyager concepts. What were your impressions of the Year of Hell?
Well, I guess I wanted to mention where we're at in Voyager. Like in season 4, we've done a lot of like the early, like TOS style shows where we just meet an alien of the week, or you know, Kim goes off and gets somebody pregnant, that sort of story. And this is sort of where they're first trying to get into the more darker elements of Star Trek, without doing the Borg, but doing a sort of, let's look at what would happen when the crew is out in the middle of nowhere and they have no friends around. What happens when they meet an enemy that can really tax them?
I definitely agree with Greg's assessment of the episode. It is one of my favorites in the entire series, for sure. I only have two major criticisms of it. And first of all, it's that it's not really consistent in the way that it's depicted with how the clips of it in before and after were shown. And some of that's a necessity, of course. No one really seemed to anticipate Kes leaving the show and being replaced with Seven of Nine. And I just feel like it almost seems like that episode's script was written when Kes was still a member of the crew, and all the role that was fulfilled by Seven of Nine was originally written for her. Because if you look at the way that she behaves in the episode, the relationship that she has with Tuvok, especially after he goes blind, it just really seems like that character dynamic is supposed to be Kes in those roles. And Seven of Nine, while she does a decent job and she's always interesting to watch on screen, doesn't really carry it with the same kind of emotional weight that I think it would have had if it had been Kes in that role. And then also the criticism that I have of it, I've had it for pretty much any time travel episode, is that there is a huge reset button at the end that, you know, it would have been interesting to see what Voyager would have been like going from that period forward, not having suffered all of those casualties. But of course, the things that they suffered during that year of hell were so terrible that there's no way they could have continued the series forward logically without doing a reset. So I can forgive it on that respect, but I also would have liked to see it maybe extended over the course of a whole season, like make it literally a year of hell. That would have been an interesting, instead of condensing all into two episodes.
That would have been,
very DS9 like, I suppose, in a way.
I agree. I feel like Year of Hell is definitely one of Voyager's bright spots in terms of storytelling. I also would have loved to have seen it be at least a season, but frankly, I think what happens in Year of Hell is basically the premise or the promise of what Voyager should have been and what we were kind of promised that it would be. Here's this crew here's this starship on their own, away from Starfleet. They don't have the ability to repair themselves, and they'll get attacked week after week. And in that situation, those attacks and those consequences would build up over time, and they wouldn't get kind of reset and forgotten the way it does most of the time in Voyager. So I like Year of Hell a lot. My major disappointment with Year of Hell is the fact that it's that bravery of storytelling doesn't exist throughout the whole show, and that within Year of Hell, like Anthony said, it gets reset at the end, like so many stories of Voyager do. It's like, oh, this was a great story that we went along with, and our characters went through a lot, and we were with them as they went through all of these terrible, terrible things, and forget all about it. It never happened. Which is one of the defining problems of Voyager in the first place. But on its own, self-contained, I think Year of Hell is an excellent, excellent piece of storytelling. And I think Anorax is one of Star Trek's best villains.
Well, I gotta say, in defense of Voyager, which is actually my favorite series for a number of reasons, I do think that people oftentimes overlook the continuity that Voyager did have at times, where if you look closely, what you see is not so much continuity of story arcs, but continuity of character development. You do see certain characters building slowly over time, certain relationships developing, references made to things that happened in previous episodes, and small arcs, if not necessarily a whole arc that reaches over the entire series. Year of Hell picks up on a few things that had come before it, but it regrettably does not leave anything after it. But within Year of Hell, you do see a lot of the great potential of what Voyager's characters had to offer. The characters on Voyager were, I think, a lot more rich and a lot more complex and a lot deeper, and I think in a lot of ways more interesting than what we had seen on some of the other series. And Year of Hell shows that very well by pushing them to their limits and putting them in situations where they would not really be able to just carry on day by day and examining what they would actually be doing in those situations. We see Janeway pushed to the limit as a captain, and seeing her in rare moments. You see it in Year of Hell, you see it in Scorpion, you see it in Equinox, where Janeway actually has to make very tough decisions that go against her Starfleet principles for the good of everyone involved, and you see it also in many other characters, just how it really is not something that could have happened on any other show. Like, I can't see Year of Hell as a Next Generation episode. I can't see it as a DS9 episode. I certainly can't see it as an Enterprise episode. Only Voyager was in that unique situation and had those characters who had those special characteristics that made it a success.
Well, actually, something interesting is that I was thinking this should have been just a season, the fourth season of Voyager. And in a way, it was the third season of Enterprise. You talk about the ship being messed up and then that continues to the next show. We had that a couple times on Enterprise where they were crippled in a battle and the next episode they actually had to deal with it. And so sort of Enterprise dealt with it a little bit. It still didn't quite take the characters to the extreme that this show, this episode did. But I think Battlestar Galactica was a show that really showed what happens when you put characters in a dire situation and just get them pounded week after week and see what they're made of.
It's a good example.
To this point, I want to say that when one thing watching Year of Hell, especially in the second part, when the ship is just so extraordinarily damaged, both on the outside and the inside, like Brian said earlier, that's more, I think, realistic to what the Voyager concept of them really truly being alone and having to fend off all the other problems and races they might encounter. And in that sense, in this episode, Voyager kind of feels more real than it does at any other point in the series. And like you said, Brian, if this were like the fourth season of Voyager was the Year of Hell, just the entire season was the Year of Hell, would have been a very interesting concept. Obviously, it couldn't have just been them being chased by the Krynum continuously. But the actual, by stretching it out over time, because it already feels, like a large story just in this two-parter, and would have been nice to have seen
They said
that.
They actually wanted to make it a four-parter, according to one of the writers, but they ended up having to pare it down to just two. That would have been really interesting if they'd really gone for it and made this a long arc, and instead of just, skipping forward a month or 3 months, actually show more levels of what was happening and just get more scenes.
In that respect, I think Voyager was a victim of its networking, the fact that it was on UPN as opposed to being in syndication like the other series. Had a lot more pressure to have that episodic format and getting rid of serialization. And it certainly could have gone that route and been a lot more interesting. They allowed it to happen on Enterprise towards the end, I guess only because of pressure that was put on them by other series that were on the air at the time that were network and yet were being serialized.
If times were different when the show was made.
Yeah, if you look at the way television has gone over the past several years, if you go back in history, you get very, very serialized concept where it was always a mandate from the networks of every show has to be self-contained and you can't really reference other episodes. And at the end of any particular episode, things have to be the way they started at the beginning of the episode. So you're not creating the sense of continuity that people feel really burdened by. But then over the years, we've had things like Twin Peaks and Babylon 5 and Lost and Battlestar that have these really serialized concepts. And it's like, and DS9 was an early pioneer of this. Mm-hmm. And then, but it was it's always this battle between writers and storytellers that want to do that kind of serialized concept, battling suits, network executives, and studio executives that are only concerned about the bottom line and always underestimate the intelligence and tenacity of the audience. They just assume that the audience is as stupid as can possibly be and go, oh, well, if everything isn't the same as it was at the beginning of the episode, then they won't get it and they'll tune out and we'll lose all that money. Unfortunately, that ends up, creating a situation where the studio executives go, no, Voyager has to be episodic and self-contained, when really the premise calls for something very, very different.
Makes you wonder what the next series will be like,
I find this problem, though, with Eureka, because Will Wheaton's on this show now. I'm trying to tune in and get caught up, and it's only in its fourth season, and I'm completely lost. Like, I watched the pilot and then this one, and all the characters are in this weird place. They're referencing all this stuff that happened, and I just want to watch this fun show, and I wonder if there isn't something to what the studios were trying to do of let new viewers come into Voyager. If they hear, oh, there's going to be this cool episode, people can tune in without having to go back and get all the DVDs.
It is definitely a balancing act, that's for sure.
Yeah, Voyager, I think, actually got the balance right in that respect, because you were able to jump into the series at any point and start watching it forward, and there would be a little bit of things carrying forward, but it wouldn't be like with DS9, where, I mean, I remember I was trying to watch DS9 and Babylon 5 simultaneously when they were on the air back in the early 90s, because I had to choose between one of them because their time slots were conflicting with one another. I ended up choosing Babylon 5 instead of DS9, but when I would try to jump back into DS9 and see what was going on, I really couldn't figure it out because I missed, you know, a couple of months, and now, right, you know, there's just, I don't know what's happening. And so I had to actually watch it from beginning to end to really to get the whole story. Voyager, it's much easier to just pick up on it and go forward. And so you can have that little bit of continuity without having it be so serialized that you can't figure out what's happening from week to week. But that's increasingly less common with every show being serialized, every show picking up where the last episode left off and having very, very little opportunity for new fans to come in. Lost was a perfect example of that.
Yeah. Times have definitely changed.
Even a show like Mad Men, which you wouldn't think would need so much continuity, there's no way you can jump into it at this point.
No, we've tried and just decided not to. So, Brian, let me ask you a question. You said, so this is the concept of Year of Hell, and to some more specifics of the story, you said at the beginning that Anorax was a great villain in this story. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about Anorax, how you felt he worked in the story, and just this kind of concept, like what we had in Generations. We have an obsession with time here again, and this kind of idea that time is like an enemy or a predator, although in this case he's trying to actually mold time to his own will.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the test of any character is how well you can relate to them, and it's always a matter of finding some very simple human action or desire for any character, hero or villain or sidekick, doesn't matter, that an audience member, any audience member, can look at and go, I get that. I know a time in my life where I felt the same thing, or I've wanted the same thing, or whatever. In this case, Anorax is just a guy who made a mistake that cost him dearly, and he's trying to fix that mistake. And that's a great, great motivation. So, and it a lot of times in Star Trek, you don't get villains with motivations that are that fleshed out, or that's at their core that relatable. So you have a sympathy with Anorax. You relate to him, and you kind of root for him in a sense. You want him to succeed, even if you don't necessarily agree with, you know. You're not supposed to want him to, you know, defeat our villain, our heroes, in the process of getting what he wants, but you still want him to succeed on his own merits. And that's always the greatest. That's always drama done the best, is when it's not just, you know, your heroes fighting a villain, and your villains who are just out to defeat your heroes because they happen to be quote unquote the heroes. It's setting up two opposing forces that both have a point, or you could see yourself on either side of the coin. So it's like the best drama is in a situation where it's two equal forces going at each other, but there's no necessarily like right or wrong to them. It's just which side of the coin you happen to fall down on. So I think Anorax is one of the best, if not the best, definitely in Voyager and of all of Star Trek, of that principle at work.
He comes across as a villain who is motivated by a sense of guilt more than anything else, and it's almost a selfish kind of guilt, but at the same time he has a greater motive, wanting to restore his great civilization that's been lost to power. But he becomes so obsessive with
but he
loses his track of what he's doing.
But even more simply than that, you know, he loved his wife. He didn't spend as much time with her as he realizes now he should have. He made that mistake, and now he's paying for it. And it's like, which, you know, is there any of us that hasn't made a mistake that ended up hurting somebody that we cared about that we wish we could take back? Or, you know, had somebody that we loved that we wish we had spent more time with that, you know, now we don't have the chance to do that anymore. So it's finding those really core, simple, relatable things that can connect with anybody in the world, any audience member ever. It's very simple, but it's really hard to do. But when you do it, and you do it well, you create a really memorable character like Anorax.
It was really interesting reading that they had part one pretty much written, and they had no idea what to do with part two. They were just completely lost. And then they
just like
set
Best
on
of
the
both
idea.
Worlds.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, it often happens
that way. So they decided to make Anorax more of a, give him this Nemo idea and make him more relatable. And with that came this idea of Chakotay being there and Chakotay sort of seeing where he's coming from. To me, this is interesting because this happens to Chakotay too many times.
Yeah, what did you think about this? Chakotay kind of, I don't, you're watching at one point and you're not sure if he's playing along with Anorax or if he's actually getting into, he's like losing himself in this idea of being able to get Voyager closer to home.
Yeah, it's not clear. At first you think he is, but then it goes along and it's like, well, you're, the way the story is clearly, the way Robert Beltran is playing it makes it seem like he's doing this intentionally, like he's playing Anorax. But then the story plays it that it's rather genuine on Chakotay's part, which doesn't really make sense because, honestly, Chakotay doesn't have that much three-dimensionality to his character, unfortunately. So he's just kind of left confused, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think that's part of the reason Beltran never quite liked his time on Star Trek, because even when they gave Chakotay things to do, it ended up being something like, well, he was on this sort of platoon planet where he was brainwashed into... That's right. And he was brainwashed into fighting for these people. And there's several other episodes, especially early on, where when he's given something to do, it's not heroic. It's just he does something wrong that then we have to fix. And it seems like he's doing that yet again in this episode. I'm glad Paris was there to slap some sense into him.
Yeah, Chakotay has always been one of the great disappointments of Voyager because of the fact that his character really was quite interesting. I mean, I would have liked to see a lot more delved into him about his background, about his beliefs, about how he became a Maquis, certainly about his relationship with Janeway. Don't get me started on that subject. But I mean, that that was a huge example of where Voyager was missed potential. I look at Voyager and I love it because of the huge potential that it had. And when I think about the mistakes that they made, the errors that they made, it just breaks my heart because I see that this show could have really been the best of all of the Star Trek series if it had just been run by people who really had a strong passion and desire to make it a little bit more less traditional in the vein of what had come before. And it certainly could have been that if they wanted it to be.
Chakotay was I felt that when they, you know, leading up between the time of before and after and the time of this story, we had Scorpion and we had Seven of Nine come on. And, you know, Kes is another character that never really worked for me, so I was glad to see Seven of Nine come on the show, because she kind of filled that gap that maybe Chakotay could have filled as a strong personality, as a counterpoint to Janeway, but he kind of couldn't because he had to be in the command structure and he had to work with Janeway in that sense. So then when we brought Seven of Nine on, Seven of Nine provided that strong personality and counterpoint to Janeway that we needed, that we didn't get from Chakotay. And, you know, you made a point earlier, Anthony, that it felt like maybe the script was written when Kes was still on the show and Seven of Nine was in this episode kind of filling in for Kes. And you know, I think that's kind of right if you think about it that way when you're watching it. There are only a few moments where they've thrown in lines to fit Seven of Nine's background, like when she tells Tuvok that as a member of the Borg, I submitted to a single authority. That was kind of maybe thrown in
when she makes reference to the events of First Contact.
First Contact,
when she's talking to
Terry Kim. Yeah, that was kind of thrown in. Yeah. So I'm curious, can you draw parallels between what Anorax is doing here and what we talked about last week with Sorin in terms of trying to manipulate time in a sense?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that this guy was given a family and a colony and a civilization he was trying to bring back, whereas Sorin, we talk about just a guy. Sorin was just one guy with no family, just really selfish. Like, he just wanted to save himself.
Well, his family was killed by the Borg. That was kind of just, but it was just thrown in. It wasn't a motivation that you had along the way. It was just kind of thrown in by Picard there towards the end.
Well, and it wasn't even that he was going to bring his family back. They were just going to be there with him in the Nexus, which, you know, Anorax wants to actually bring his family back and bring his civilization back and have that be real life.
Which I think the key difference between the two is a problem of just the fact that we never see what Sorin wants. And it would have taken just one scene where we see basically, you know, what we get from Picard's point of view. We see Picard with his ideal family. If we had seen Soren with his version of his ideal family, we can go, okay, I can relate. You know, I had this and I miss it and I want it back. But we never see that, which I think is a larger problem of generations, that we don't see the things that are important to see. Like, you know, Kirk gives his life to save this planet full of people that we never, ever see. And it's like, right. Well, wait, why was this a great big sacrifice again? For these people that have only been mentioned in one sentence, that
right.
Dramatically, it's not a very strong way of doing things. And I think with Soren, it's the same thing. We saw what Anorax wanted and what he was doing translated into a relatable need. We never really saw that with Soren, and as a result, it translates, I think, into a more selfish portrayal that you don't necessarily relate to as well. You go, oh, he's just a selfish jerk, as opposed to he's filled with a lot of pain, and I can relate to that.
Yeah, definitely. So Anorax does end up being much more fleshed out, and so I think that works really well, even though maybe going into the episode they didn't know what they were going to be doing with Anorax. And also they made his second command quite a character too. This guy who,
yeah, they
he
did.
Was like going along yeah. and he, yeah, was, they, he was happy to be part of it, but he wasn't sure.
They made him into what Chakotay should have been all along.
Right.
They actually gave some real conflict between the first officer and the captain or the commander.
Good point.
I thought it was interesting that...
That's a good point.
That's not to say that they didn't never had any conflict between Janeway and Chakotay. I mean,
right.
That did happen on a fairly regular basis, that Janeway felt like Chakotay was no longer trustworthy. I mean, Scorpion was the perfect example of that, but it could happen more
Scorpion,
often, I suppose.
I agree. In Scorpion, they do it fairly well. In my opinion, just it's inconsistent. Like the writing on Voyager, more than anything else, is inconsistent in any one of those regards, in any one of those aspects or characters.
There was no way they could have been in conflict for the entire series, though. I mean, after 7 years, sooner or later, they had to be on good terms with one another.
On the ship itself, like showing... So while Chakotay was away, we sort of saw how she was dealing with, I guess, two people, mostly Tuvok and the Doctor, where Tuvok really wanted to be loyal to the captain, even though he really wasn't agreeing with what she was doing. And the Doctor, we were talking about this, Chris, where he just has this moment where he just stands up to her and says, you know, I can't let you do this. You know, I have a duty to make you step down, and I'm going to. And she says, you really have no power.
Yeah, and she refuses, and that's when the Doctor has his violent films moment, when he says, I hope you know this will go down on your permanent record. but it is. And going back to Chakotay, like you said, in Scorpion, they played up that conflict pretty well. But I felt like for most of the series, there was a lot of manufactured conflict between Janeway and Chakotay. And then Chakotay always acquiesced very easily to Janeway.
I think he just
when they try to do that, it always feels very contrived. It doesn't feel organic to the characters or the situation. It just feels like every now and then the writers go, oh, wait, there should be conflict here. Okay, we'll have half an episode of conflict. And then by the next episode, everything's back to the reset button again.
You know, I have to wonder if that's not because of the fact that we had a female captain and a male first officer. Mm-hmm. And that the producers felt like they would be... treading on dangerous ground if they had this male first officer constantly questioning the female captain, and some women might interpret that as being, you know, sexist or something. I mean, I guess it was uncharted territory for them, so I can forgive it, but...
Yeah, that's quite possible, especially in the mid-90s when the series was under development. So, Greg, going back to the foreshadowing of this episode,
right.
Before and after, I know this is what you call the Great Voyager Continuity Experiment. So why don't you tell us a little bit also what you call the before and after conundrum in relation to the Year of Hill.
So last season, season 3, we had the episode Before and After. It's a great, great episode that starts with Kes being really old, and then she ages backwards through the episode. It's kind of like Memento in structure. And a really interesting thing happens where she finds out that they're going to come up on this thing called the Year of Hell, where the ship gets attacked by... They even say the Krenim, and they even talk about Chronoton torpedoes. We see a scene where Kes goes and finds the Chronoton torpedo and finds out... So it's a big part of Before and After. And after that, they were thinking of doing the Year of Hell concept as... the season 3 finale, and then everything happened where they decided to bring Seven of Nine on the show, and they had Scorpion, so they pushed this back. And it really, I guess the crux of it is the episode The Gift, where Kes pushes Voyager past Borg space, which to me that seems like either they're not pushed past Borg space and they encounter the Krenim and then Kes is there, or they are pushed past Borg space and Kes isn't there, and then this whole year of hell should never have even happened. Kes should have saved them from this.
Furthermore, she warned Janeway at the end of Before and After that the Krenim were coming, supposedly, although we never actually saw what she said, but she was supposed to deliver a report. Yeah. So how is it that when Janeway finally ran up against them that she did not, oh, this is exactly what Kes warned us about. We need to, like, go this other direction.
Exactly.
It makes me wonder if Year of Hell itself is not set in some sort of an alternate timeline from the rest of the series.
Apparently there's a book that solves this, that says... I forget what it was, but somehow this is an alternate reality. The book solves everything.
Yeah.
Was it written by J.J. Abrams?
But a Star Trek non-canon book that uses an alternate universe theory to solve a continuity issue. Yeah.
Was it written by William Shatner?
That's pretty much par for the course. Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, this is quite possible. It's one, I really like this episode, and it's really fun to watch. But I'm always kind of left with all of this kind of erasing things from history and restoring them and erasing them and restoring them. And then you just kind of start to wonder if anything's real and if any of the timelines are real. And that just leads us to kind of the way it wraps up, which is the reset button. You know, time's up. Here's the reset button. And suddenly everything is just perfectly fine again.
I love where they took Janeway, too. I love that she rams Voyager into this... into the ship.
Yeah.
They do a similar thing in Battlestar. I guess no one's on the ship, but they ram a ship into the bad guy's ship to destroy it.
Pegasus, right into the ship. Yeah,
right. So, and I guess it happens in the new Star Trek movie. I love these moments where we have to ram our ship in. And of course, you can't actually destroy Voyager. So at this point, you know, well, they're going to have to reset everything. And immediately we see, oh, well, there's Voyager and she doesn't even have a scratch on her. It's just... Everything, big red reset.
Well, it was
button.
Kind of like the cause and effect moment when they finally get out of the temporal causality loop and the Enterprise is just flying and everything's perfectly fine again. It's
now, see, if they had kept Kes, they could have done something kind of similar to what they did in yesterday's Enterprise, which was even though the whole episode was reset at the end, there was still some lingering knowledge of what happened because Guinan somehow didn't forget.
Right.
So if they had Kes, because Kes was capable of seeing outside of different timelines because of her special abilities, we could have actually maybe had a little bit of continuity that there was some memory of what the events of that Year of Hell actually happened that would have been carried on to the rest of the series.
Yeah, they wanted to have Chakotay ask the Krenim guy at the end, like, ask him something about this colony and ask if it's still there. And then the guy says, oh, I've never heard of that. But they couldn't figure out any way to make Chakotay, why would Chakotay remember? So they ended up having to cut that.
Yeah.
There's a great comparison to be made in the difference of storytelling between this Year of Hell episode of Voyager and the moments, I don't remember which season it is exactly, of Battlestar, but there's a moment in Battlestar where you really believe for a second that they might be about to destroy the Galactica and kill Edward James Olmos and a bunch of other main characters. And it lingers, and based on everything that the show had done up to that point, it lingers on this shot of the Galactic just getting the crap beaten out of it and really just battered all to hell. And it just lingers and lingers and lingers there for a second. And you really have time to think they're about to blow up the title ship here. And you really think they might pull the trigger on that, versus in Year of Hell or any number of other examples from Voyager, where they try to kind of set up that same moment of oh god, but just based on how you kind of know how Voyager works, you never really think that they have the guts to pull it off. And whether that's the guts of the producers or whether that's the guts of the studio executives and the TV executives, we'll never know, probably for sure one way or the other. But it's, you know, storytelling is all about setup and payoff. It's you set something up and then you pay off that idea. And whether or not that payoff works, and that payoff is usually just one moment, all depends on whether you set something up properly and whether you set it up so that your audience totally buys into that payoff. And Battlestar was good at doing that, at going, oh, crap, they could kill anybody or they could blow anything up and they will actually do it. I believe that they will do it. Versus Voyager, which based on how they did things, you could always kind of tell, like, well, they're not really going to go through it. They're just going to push the reset button at the end.
I think your pal is
a great example of that.
At the end of the series, you have to realize that the Voyager crew hasn't gone through as much stuff as we saw. Like maybe, right. I don't know, a third of the stories got reset. So they've actually had a pretty hunky-dory time, all things considered.
I don't know if it was that much of the series they got reset. That seems like an exaggeration, but I know Year of Hell got reset before and after. And what other major... I mean, some of... from the Voyager perspective, Future's End happened, so...
Yeah, it's true.
I don't know.
Well, there's all the events that happened in the finale that that Future Janeway reset.
Oh, well, like
years and years.
32, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Let's not get started on the series finale.
Oh, well. Okay.
Yeah,
do I have things to say about
time.
That?
I have
that might be some of the worst television writing I've ever seen in my entire life.
Well, I can just say that I've made the best of it in some things that I've written, but that's not a subject for this podcast.
we'll get to that.
Yeah. Well, kind of since we're at the reset button, we're kind of at the end of the episode here. Just in closing, let me just ask you: does the fact that everything just completely resets at the end does it weaken the story for you? Do you feel like you were shortchanged when you get to the end?
Yes, absolutely. Because it's about spending time with characters. It's and how much you care about the story and characters and what happens to them and the end point that they eventually get to is a direct function of how much time you spend with them and how much you witness them and, you know, in a certain part of our brain participate with them in what they go through. And when you take characters along these journeys, and in the case of Year of Hell, these really incredibly difficult journeys, and then at the end you go, just kidding, none of that ever happened. Yeah. It cheats you out of this journey. You spent 2 hours investing this time and the emotions in that time of, you know, identifying and sympathizing and empathizing with these characters, and then at the end they go, oh, that didn't count.
Yeah,
and it is in a very real sense cheating the audience, and you do it too often.
You don't want Voyager to be destroyed, but you want to have some lingering.
But you need to impact, you need to have consequences. Yeah, you need to have some sense of continuity, not in a, you know, a Star Trek sense, but a continuity of emotion, of empathy, of going, okay, last week they were here at point M in their journey, and now they're at point N. And when you use these time travel gimmicks to reset things and jump and skip and erase, you go, okay, last week we're at B, and now we're at N, and now we're going to go back and show you M, but M doesn't actually matter, and next week we'll be at T. And it just doesn't work that way. Yeah. As a human being, you can't connect with what another person is going through in that way.
Yeah, like you look at the different relationships this episode developed, where you have Seven and Tuvok getting along. You have maybe Chakotay coming to some understandings about himself and understanding this Stockholm Syndrome problem he has. You have Janeway having so much character development. And then the next episode, literally the writers tell you, forget about that. None of that happened.
Right.
This episode comes after a month ago. So remember how things were a month ago? That's how they are now. And that's a problem watching the series. And it's a problem week to week. I think as an episode, this episode works really well, and it was really daring of the producers to do. If you think about it in context of what they were supposed to be doing, which was a fairly generic episodic sci-fi show, to do something this outlandish, to show a whole year in just 2 hours, is a pretty powerful thing. And so it's sort of like, I don't know, maybe if you go back and read a Voyager novel that's written now that takes place in that time period, it has nothing to do with the actual series, and you shouldn't read it in the context of that. But as a alternate timeline story, I think it works really, really well, and I'm so glad they did it.
Yeah. I agree. I do
you get
like
into
the
story.
It.
It's just at the very end you feel like, wait, you know, while you're watching it, it works really well.
Which is contrary to, and I forget the name of the episode, but there's one where Voyager is like split, and they're... Harry Kim and the baby end up, you know, jumping from one ship.
Yeah.
And you think they're going to pull their standard reset button. Oh, everything Voyager has gone through doesn't matter, and the ship is perfectly okay.
Yeah.
But they end up reversing that and go, and the ship that's been all beat to hell is the one that actually survives at the end of the episode.
Of course, they never touch on the fact that Harry Kim and Naomi Wildman were technically not really Harry Kim and Naomi Wildman for the whole series.
I know.
Yeah. I mean,
that's right.
But I love that point. And I think they do, reference it obliquely, once or twice. It kind of comes up in conversation, but it's not a big deal. So it's like, oh yeah, technically I don't belong here by 13 seconds or whatever it is.
What was the episode where Kim found his home world and he had spots? I forget that episode.
I know which episode you're talking about.
That was going to be
favorite son.
That was favorite son. Thank you.
Favorite
that
son,
was going to
be
an ongoing thing. Like Kim was going to have spots, and he was going to be from the Delta Quadrant from then on the series. And then they totally chickened out and decided not to do that.
That was just a little bit of an outlandish story.
Harry has chicken pox.
I'm going to try to be the devil's advocate here, though, and say that even though the reset button does kind of bother me, and I understand what Brian and Greg are saying, for me, it doesn't really diminish the enjoyability of that episode. I really feel like even if the character development doesn't carry on, it does give you a little bit of a glimpse into what happens within the characters' minds on a daily basis. You can keep in mind that, okay, they're not given a situation where they can actually explore it, but
true.
Behind the scenes, this is what's going on. The scene that sticks out to me the most in this respect is when Chakotay gives Janeway the watch. And that watch symbolizes so very much that he saved up his replicator rations all this time to try to give her this gift because of, a sign of, how he cares about her, what he wants her to understand. And she just says, she really appreciates it, but then she says, okay, take it. We're going to, destroy it because this is somebody's meal. But she never actually does. It's still there, like, towards the end. So it kind of gives you a little glimpse there of that relationship between Janeway and Chakotay, which is unfortunately never really explored as fully as it could be. And it really also can be forgiven because if you look at the way the episode unfolds and how it ends, the writers kind of painted themselves into a corner to the point where there really was no way for them to continue on the episode besides having the reset button. I mean, if the only way for them to reset everything was for them to crash Voyager into the Krenim ship, I mean, how are you going to continue Voyager on after that without a reset button? I mean, unless it's the series finale, So I can forgive them for it, but it certainly was an example of what Voyager could be when the writers really put a lot of effort into it. And there were a few other examples of when they achieved that high level, but this was really where you see seasons 4 and 5 was really the peak of this series, where the writing was top-notch. And you really see that the show came into its own in a really big and serious way. And it disappoints me that they weren't able to carry that on into 6th and 7th seasons, which really became almost unbearable at some times. But Year of Hell is one of the most outstanding 2 hours of science fiction that was made in the 90s, in my view.
I guess my final word on it would be that I wish I could say that Year of Hell was the turning point in Voyager, where they decided to go full continuity, have damages to the ship go on from week to week, have the characters really develop. Instead, it sort of stands as this point where they did a big experiment in continuity and then followed up on DS9 and didn't really get back to it on Voyager. So as an experiment, it's great. I love it. It's just not exactly what I wanted it to be.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Well, that's been a great discussion of Year of Hell. Like everything we talk about on here, we could go on forever, for hours at least, but we'll try to rein things in a little bit. So Brian and Anthony, I really appreciate you joining us for today.
Thanks for having
and
us.
Brian, tell us where people can find you around the web.
You can always find me on Twitter at brianfinisher.com. I'm sorry, my username is Brian Finisher. I also have a website, brianfinisher.com, that I never update. And I'm also on a podcast, downinfront.net, where we record our own commentaries to movies, and we have really fun conversations that go kind of like this on a good day about whatever movie we're watching, and like we just did Temple of Doom, and we try to figure out why Temple of Doom doesn't work. Oh, thank you. Yeah, we thought that was one of our better commentaries recently. So definitely, if you like movies and you like having smart conversations about movies, definitely check out downinfront.net.
All right, and Anthony, tell everyone where they can find you.
Well, I have my Twitter account. My username is Antodav, A-N-T-O-D-A-V. And I talk about a wide variety of subjects on there, things that are going on in my daily life, as well as you know, science fiction, politics, religion, all sorts of different subjects. I welcome anybody to come and follow me if you want to, but I also caution you that I can be controversial sometimes. I also want to make sure that everybody, if you're a hardcore Star Trek fan, follow the Trek Trivia account, which I, myself and Mark Stamper run on a weekly basis. We switch off every week, and it's just fun Trek trivia that you can play, and we love to have new people come in and add to the community that we have here, so definitely check us out there too.
And it's definitely fun when not Shatner is on.
Yes, oh, yeah. Yeah,
great. All right. Well, thanks again for joining us,
thanks
guys.
Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Chris, that was a great discussion about Voyager. I was really glad to have Brian Finister and Anthony Davis with us.
Yeah, me too. It's one of my favorite episodes of Voyager, and it's, like we said in the show, it's really highlights what Voyager could have been if the writers had taken more chances.
Right.
Great episode. Well, before we leave everybody today, let's tell people where they can find us around the web. We really would love to hear your thoughts on the Year of Hail and any of the other news stories that we talked about. Just drop by trek.fm/contact and send us a note, or you can leave us a voicemail by calling 646-652-TREK. And you'll also find us on Twitter. Username is TrekFM. And Greg, you're also on Twitter.
That's right. I tweet at Greg Harbin. That's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N. Talk about Star Trek, Apple, bunch of things, but definitely write to me. I'll write you back. I've been having some great discussions about Star Trek recently, so please join in.
If you want to get Greg's attention, just preface every tweet with Glommer, and he'll reply
yes.
right away.
I've got a search set up. Anytime someone mentions a Glommer, I am on it.
And I'm on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y. And you'll also find us on Facebook. If you'd like to like us, we'd like you to like us. And lastly, as Anthony mentioned at the end of our feature, if you want to test your Trek IQ, you can play Trek Trivia, both on Twitter by following username Trek Trivia. Those are live quizzes done several times a week by Mark and Anthony. And also, we have a multiple choice trivia quiz on our site at trek.fm/trektrivia. Well, it looks like we have concluded another show.
Yes, Chris, I think it's time to stick a temporal incursion in it, because the Ready Room is done.